This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. A protracted global economic crisis is fueling unrest around the world. Revolutions are rocking North Africa, the Middle East, and rioters have flooded the streets of London. Here in America, we're being told to remain calm. Everything will be okay.
America is going to come back from this recession stronger than before. That I'm convinced of. I believe that.
That is President Obama reminding folks in Iowa this week that the American dream, the hope of a solid middle-class life, is still within our grasp. But what exactly does it mean to be middle-class? And how attainable is that dream in America today? Taking a look at the state of the middle class, joining me in the studio is Sarah Appel. She is a graduate student in literature at Duke University and a blogger for the site's Working Class Perspectives from the Center for Working Class Studies at SUNY Stony Brook. Welcome, Sarah. Good to have you here.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be here.
On the phone with us, Michael Bowen. He's visiting assistant professor of history at Westminster College in Wilmington, Pennsylvania, author of The Roots of Modern Conservatism, Dewey, Taft, and the Battle for the Soul of the Republican Party. Michael, hello.
Hello. Glad to be here.
Taking your phone calls and emails today, do you think you're in the middle class? Are you struggling to maintain your status, whatever you think that is? Give us a call, 877-962-9862, SOT@WUNC.org. Sarah, let's talk first about what it means to be middle class. I know you've done a lot of research on both the real people, but also kind of in popular culture, how the middle class has been reflected. Give us that pop culture reflection of who we are as middle class people, if we are.
Yeah, I've been doing a lot of work lately on film and television and graphic novels and, you know, some of these popular texts that, like, really do take up these class issues about, you know, class and identity. You know, what does it mean to be working class? What does it mean to be middle class? Or what does it mean to envision yourself, you know, as poor or working class, but, like, desiring, I guess, you know, the capital, the resources, the power, and the, you know, the peace of mind that we think of when we think of what it means to have a middle class lifestyle. And I think, and one of the texts that I've looked at recently in a recent chapter of my dissertation, which really kind of takes up these issues in detail, focuses on the television show Friday Night Lights. Some of you out there might be familiar with the show. It's sort of become an obsession of mine, and I think part of the reason for that is because I grew up in the same kind of small town, very football, sports craze kind of place that is the focus of that show.
Give us a little synopsis.
Okay, and so basically, what the show focuses on is, you know, this football loving town and community, and the two main characters of the show are this couple, Eric and Tammy Taylor, and one of them is a football coach. He's like the main coach, you know, for this 5A superstar Texas football team. And then there's his wife, Tammy, and she's a guidance counselor who later becomes a principal. You know, and so these two, and you know, within this small town setting, are, you know, they're very much a part of the community, but they're a couple that you would definitely think of as middle class and very much an idealized kind of middle class couple, even down to the sort of egalitarian gender politics. I mean, they're just the greatest couple ever. They love each other. They're, you know, you want to be them, really, as a viewer. But what's interesting about them, and what I argue, is that they're actually like part of the reason that they're able to kind of sustain that aspirational middle class face has to do with the fact that they serve working class people, and you know, in both of those occupations are you know, a guidance counselor or a coach. They're there to serve the community in these ways, and so, you know, in order to really maintain their own standard of living and even their status to us as viewers of the show as middle class, they have to serve that community according to that to that community's values. And, and sometimes their own interests and their own desire to kind of like claim, you know, this middle class attitude toward life comes into conflict sometimes with the prerogatives of this working class community. And also, what's interesting is that throughout the show, you know, and this is a show that's running, you know, over the course of about the same time that we got into this economic recession and, you know, the current situation we're facing. These characters actually they undergo sort of upward and downward mobility in interesting ways throughout the show. And oftentimes, you know, those moments where, you know, the downward mobility occurs, there's been some kind of a fissure with the community, you know. And so really what it's about is this is a middle class couple that's having to really acknowledge that their own livelihood is really dependent in many ways on creating a kind of solidarity, like with the working class people that they serve. And this is an idea that kind of takes us to the heart of, how do we define middle class from, you know, from something like working class?
And it is showing up in pop culture, TV shows like Friday Night Lights, graphic novels, as you said. I want to take one step back, and then we'll pursue this a little more deeply as our conversation continues. But Michael Bowen, I want to step back and talk about when this concept of the middle class emerged in America.
Well, the middle class is standards change with each generation, and there's still discussion today whether middle class is economic status, is it educational status, is it behavior status. But you saw a transition actually very early, 1830s, 1840s, in the early industrial period, where you saw people going from what was termed the middling sorts, who were people who wanted to distinguish themselves from sort of low life, sort of roguish people, and they weren't upper class, they weren't elites, they weren't the, you know, large farmers, but they were not the lower class, the poor, the destitute either. And as the industrial economy took hold and as a service economy developed, you started to see a distinction, and the lines have always been blurry, about how these people could distinguish themselves from this lower group and how they aspired to be better than them and aspires to sort of create this, what we call today, middle-class existence. And you see it change throughout 1840s. It changes again in the 19-teens with the progressive period, where you saw sort of a professional educated class emerge, doctors, lawyers, people trying to sort of set standards of behavior for their professions, as well as standards of behavior in life, you know, settlement house movements for hygiene and so on. And by the time you get to post-war period, the middle class has become numerically the dominant class in society. There are more middle class than there are either ends of the spectrum. And people have to sort of figure out what to do with them. C. Wright Mills, the sociologist who's sort of a patron saint of the New Left, wrote about this in 1951. And the opening line to his book's called White Collar, the opening line to his book is the white-collar people slipped quietly into modern society. So they've sort of always been there. There's always been a middle class, but what it means to be middle class has always been a moving target.
And it's always required, as you say, Michael, these markers, because it's a distinction that seems to be important, particularly in our society as this nation evolved. And so what those markers were and how you distinguished yourself, whether it's property ownership or real or personal property, those are the things that we're going to talk about today. And I want to go to the phones. Michael is on the line from Boston. Hello, Michael.
Yes. Well, first of all, fundamentally, I think it has to do with fear, the level of fear you've got for your life and for your family's health. But what that's unfair of me to add. But what I originally called about was just to say that I'd say the essence of the middle class is that it's a group of people who are heavily enough invested in the system that they're not going to question the property rights of the rich too much.
Well, that's an interesting point, Michael, and I thank you for your call. Invested to the point that they don't want to rock the boat or question the property rights, and yet, are those people who claim to be middle class today truly invested when we look at sort of what kind of ownership we have over our jobs and assets, Sarah?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really big, important issue, because I think that, part of being middle class is about aspiration. You know, it's not. I would say that that's probably the primary thing that it's about. Like the other guest just mentioned. It's about like there's someone at the bottom that I'm not like, and I want to disidentify from in this way. You know, I mean, I think this relates to sort of how nebulous it is for us to define middle class. Is that, you know, there are those people that aren't hardworking, and I'm not like them. I'm playing by the rules.
Right.
You see, and I think there's this conception that if I play by the rules well enough, and I accept sort of this, you know, this social standard of, you know, what it means to go out and get a job, you know, and raise a family and all this, that, you know, one day I'll get my piece of the pie, you know, like those rich people,
right?
You know,
but,
who seem to sort of have so much of everything. And I want to identify with that sort of vision as, you know, what it is that I value. And so I think that it is difficult to sort of then turn and see that, you know, and think, but wow, you know, maybe actually the rules that I thought I was playing by were kind of rigged from the get-go for me to not necessarily, like, get all that much.
Well, and the asset, right, because the assets that I have don't really reflect the aspiration that I hold, Michael Bowen. I mean, we really don't own much in terms of anything that can build equity apart from a house, and fewer people even have that these days.
Well, there is, you know, we now have the infrastructure where people are invested in private pensions through 401ks, through, you know, most employer-based systems, and I think that's certainly a sign of the middle class. If you have, you know, a retirement account, we're constantly bombarded on television with advertisements, you know, follow the green line for that one particular company and invest that way. So it definitely builds up this aspirational aspect that we may not be rich, but we may be secure. So there's no real incentive to challenge property rights or challenge the economic system because there is supposedly a way we can carve out our own place in that.
On the State of Things today, talking about the state of the middle class with Sarah Appel. She's a graduate student in literature at Duke University. Michael Bowen is a visiting assistant professor of history at Westminster College in Wilmington, Pennsylvania. Taking your phone calls at 877-962-9862. Send us an email at sot@wunc.org. Just ahead, why the nest egg is a thing of the past. You're listening to the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacia. We're talking about the decline of America's middle class, what that means. Joining me in the studio is Sarah Appel. She's a graduate student in literature at Duke University and a blogger for Working Class Perspectives from the Center for Working Class Studies at SUNY Stony Brook. With us on the phone is Michael Bowen, a visiting assistant professor of history at Westminster College in Wilmington, Pennsylvania. He's the author of The Roots of Modern Conservatism, Dewey, Taft, and the Battle for the Soul of the Republican Party. I want to welcome two more guests to the conversation. Scott Spiegel is chief financial officer with the Durham-based America Institute for Certified Public Accountants, and Michal Grinston Weiss is a director of the Assets Building Group and an associate professor at UNC School of Social Work. I want to welcome both of you to the program.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure.
And we're welcoming your phone calls as well at 877-962-9862, sot@wunc.org. Are you middle class? Are you now, or have you ever been a member of the middle class? And what does that mean? Let's talk about it. Scott, a couple of markers that we've already discussed. I mean, whether we're invested, whether we somehow have a piece of the rock, whether it's through our house or 401k. But another marker of middle class had been saving. Savings. That seems to have gone the way of the dodo.
Yeah, I mean, the savings rate is a big demarcation. I mean, back in the 2000s, you know, as a profession, the CPAs have been studying this for a while, and the savings rate back then was at 1%, and how that compares to the rest of the world was very low. With that, we created a website, 360financialliteracy.org, to really help educate Americans on how to save. And as luck would have it, you know, our savings rate now is over 5%. But we're also struggling with other issues that are out there now between the real estate market and other economic factors that are out there. So it's really an issue. But, you know, we have to continue to educate most Americans on how to save.
Why do Americans save so little?
Well, I think it's a combination of a lot of factors. I think it's fear and uncertainty in the markets. I think it's the devaluation of homes, which the home was the safety net for most people's savings when home prices were so high. And those are probably just some of the key factors that are out there.
Michael Bowen, it would seem to me, too, one of the other factors might be that if you're trying to maintain your status, if it's aspiration rather than sort of any other kind of marker like income or total assets, then you've got to keep up with the Joneses. You got to make it look like you're middle class and spend that money that you might have saved.
Yeah, there's a very good argument out there that a lot of the post-war boom starting in the 40s and 50s, the suburban boom, was driven by that consumerism. The idea that you needed to have the newest automobile, the newest appliance to keep up, and certainly our consumer-driven society today continues that. You see that when you see shows on television like MTV Cribs and you see advertisements, again, pushing the latest and greatest things, people do want to definitely show themselves, if not upper class, at least middle class, through what they wear and what they drive and what they consume.
But that brings us to the question of whether or not we define ourselves by income or as some other status. Michal, can you give us a sense economically what we mean when we call ourselves middle class?
Right. That's an excellent question. I think it's for many years we were focusing in America on measuring the middle class and measuring financial well-being by focusing on income. And recently with the work of Michael Schraden and the book on assets and the poor, we're shifting to a more focus on looking at assets as well, assets and wealth. And let me define what wealth means. Wealth is measured as individual net value of assets such as home equity, saving or retirement pension, minus debt such as home loan or credit card debt. And so let me just put, you know, some statistics to illustrate this point and this inequality and the different statistics we could get when measuring this definition with income versus health. So in 2001, around 20% of U.S. households were considered as income poor, 20%. But using an assets poverty measure, which measured as saving equal to 3 months at the poverty level income, the proportion is closer to 50%. So 20% income measure and 50% with assets measure.
And this is a poverty measure. In other words, considered poor if by income, but by assets, a far greater number.
Absolutely. And so the takeaway message is that much larger portion of Americans are assets poor than income poor, and then the middle class is shrinking even faster when we're using an assets-based definition.
Are assets different than possessions? Are we talking about things that somehow are able to leverage and give you greater security rather than just owning a boat or a car?
Exactly. So when we talk about assets are things that help you do more than just meet basic need when you compare it to income. Assets enable people to create opportunities to invest in productive assets such as education or home ownership, having room to plan and dream for the future or pass opportunities to future generation. As Ray Bouchard, a former director of the Assets Building in New America Foundation, said, lack of income means you don't get by, but lack of assets means you don't get ahead.
And that's the chief aspiration of the middle class, the fact that you could get ahead. This is
right.
The belief. And yet we can see that in terms of assets, that's simply not true for half of the population.
Yeah. I mean, and thinking about what Mikhail was saying, I think we really have to take into account how sort of intoxicating that aspiration to be middle class is when, if you're thinking about, if you look at poverty in terms of income and it's 20%, and if you look at it in terms of assets, it's 50%, what it means to own a home, and to think of yourself as a homeowner, regardless of, whatever kind of subprime mortgage might be being offered to you, and there was, and the way those mortgages were offered, I think there's a lot of documentation that proves that, even the rhetoric behind it, own the dream, you too can be a homeowner, and sort of, again, that desire to aspire to this thing that, regardless of whether or not your standard of living and your income and what it takes to build those assets is actually there and available, it's a very intoxicating vision. And so you can understand how, so much of our country was really taken in by that, because that is the thing that keeps you from having to say, oh, gosh, maybe I'm poor.
Right.
I have a home. How could I be poor if I have a home?
And rebellion against the powers arrayed against you would be rebellion against your own aspiration. A kind of annihilating your own dream. So, Scott, what is it that keeps us from saving? Is it that we just don't know this good stuff, that we got to put our money away because we want to build assets, as Mikhail said, education, all these important things? Or is it because we simply can't, that we're just not in a place to save?
I think it's a combination of both. I think part of it is an education issue. And I think we have to continue to educate Americans and help make them go from being financially literate to financially independent. But I also think there's also fear and uncertainty out there, too, that becomes part of that reason why they can't save. The job market, housing market, food prices are high, gas prices are high. And so I think this education process to really get people to think about making small changes to their lifestyle can really help them make a big difference. And so that's what our job is as CPAs, is to really help educate folks and I think that's how we're going to get on the road to recovery.
Let's take a phone call now. Scott is on the line from Raleigh. Hi, Scott.
Hello. How are you?
Good.
I had a comment. I was reflecting on the middle class. Are you there?
Yeah.
Okay. I was reflecting on the middle class and thinking back to my grandparents, where the middle class was defined a little more in some simple terms. They had one car, a home less than 2,000 square feet. They didn't have cell phones, no high-speed internet, et cetera, et cetera. So what I'm saying is our culture, in my mind, is pushing the middle class out of financial security by allowing too much credit and the idea that you need too many things to sort of keep up with the neighbors or to keep up with the latest fashion. I think that was mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
So I think the dilemma is that, you know, human nature is you want what you see others have, and those things in our culture define you, but they actually cause the financial insecurity. And I also believe that it's human nature to be optimistic. You know, you want something now. Mm-hmm. They're letting me have it now. And by having it now, I'll make the money in the future. Yeah. My job outlook will be better. I'll have more income, and I'll pay for this later.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I think the credit is too tight, or excuse me, too loose in our culture.
Well, let me ask you, Scott. Thank you, Scott, for the question. And Scott Spiegel, I'll put it to you. Is that part of the problem? Is that part of your advice, spending not so much on those things that make you look wealthy, invest in your real wealth?
Yeah, I mean, it is amazing. I mean, if you think about all of the gadgets that we have now and the keeping up with the Joneses mentality, I mean, our education process is to really help people to make different choices. You know, one of the campaigns that we had run was to just say, do you really need that latte at, you know, Coffee House X? Because you can save money by brewing it at home. So again, these little changes can make very, very big differences over time. And so I do think that there is a peer pressure, but I think that there is some self-ownership of being able to make those changes and taking a step back to say, I think I can.
Yeah. Sarah?
Can I jump in here? Because I think that we need to make maybe a little bit more of a fine distinction, though, between consumption and just sort of like everyday things that we own and want and an asset. Like what you were getting at, you know, what it means to have an asset like a home, because I think that we're treading a fine line here that can get dangerous between, you know, really wanting to promote policy, you know, promote this idea of saving. And I don't think anybody would argue with that, you know, as being a good thing. I mean, I'd personally love to be able to save much more than I can. But when you get into judgment as a result of an inability to save, then what we see are things like what, you know, this report that came out from the Heritage Foundation that was an attempt to redefine poverty around the idea, you know, I think it was called air conditioners, something else, and an Xbox, you know, what poverty means in America today. And, you know, basically,
well, the idea that if you had a cell phone that can't
cell phone,
eat, somehow,
can't, yeah,
somehow you're
some,
not worthy
somehow you're
of public
not poor.
Assistance.
Oh,
yeah.
How could you possibly be poor? You have these things.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's kind of absurd. I mean, especially, you know, in North Carolina, if you don't have air conditioning, I don't know if you were here for the heat wave over the last several weeks, you really can't survive. A microwave, that was another one of the things that, you know, was a part of this sort of like austerity mentality. And I mean, that's a re-demonization of the poor, I think, in this way. You know, it's almost like a punishment for your condition. Yeah, I mean, what should we get to the point where we're working 80 hours a week at non-unionized jobs that don't pay benefits and living like Buddhist monks? I mean, is that sort of what it should mean
well,
to
I mean,
be poor
it
in
raises,
this country?
It raises interesting questions about the level of consumerism and an economy that depends on ever more consumption, which is a kind of a crazy thought in human history if you think about using up
and
your resources.
You know, our identities as consumers, to be good is to consume now.
Right. Mikhail? Right.
I want to offer a different perspective. I want to talk about how institutions of society make it easy or hard to save and encouraging savings. For example, our government, our employers, our banks. So let me show you two examples. For example, think about payroll direct deposit. No, direct deposit make it easy, painless way for employee to save money each payday without having to make any conscientious decision about that. However, middle-class non-professional are less likely to have access to direct deposit opportunities through their employer. Likewise, people who work in the public sector, like myself and my colleague at UNC, or those who work in the private sector for large corporation, are typically offered retirement saving plans that not only make saving easy and attractive, but many times make participation mandatory. So in contrast, many middle-class full-time workers do not have employer-sponsored retirement plans, which create barriers to building retirement savings. So it's not any a priority decision that we make. It's just that for upper middle class and upper class, it's become much easier. And for low-income families, there are a lot more barriers to enter the saving mechanism.
And things like health care and education are assets. And if you can't afford
right.
them and you have no access to them, then you're really asset poor.
And if you're living paycheck to paycheck, I mean, and I think that's a really important distinction between like a working class life and a middle class life as well. You know, if you're middle class, technically you have access to these resources. You have access to a steady income. You have access to enough benefits that you're not going to have to blow all your steady income on health care because your kid broke their leg or whatever. You know, like that. I mean, those are really important things that have to be in place for us to actually have the means to begin to save, you know, in the way that I think we would all love to be able to save. And so we have to, you know, we have to stop focusing on the little things like Xboxes, you know, and think about those other priorities.
It is interesting, though, how all of these things come together. We talked earlier about the TV show Friday Night Lights and these families on the threshold of middle class kind of working back and forth and their aspiration versus their condition. And I think there's a clip that we're going to play that kind of brings all this together. Sarah, yeah. I'd like you to set it up for us.
Okay. The clip that we're going to see here, it's actually interesting because this is a clip between two brothers. A scene between two brothers, Tim Riggins and Billy Riggins. And it's interesting because Billy, the brother that you'll see as part of the argument, was encouraging Tim to go to college for years and years. He was like, Tim, you have to go to college. You're going to be the first person in our family to go to college. I didn't go, you know, so it was almost sort of like this. He wanted him to go. And Tim, we all know, is, you know, college isn't going to be really for this guy. He was a football star. And his dream is actually to stay in town and open an auto repair business with his brother. But anyway, his brother pressures him to go to college instead. But ultimately, you know, he just doesn't want to be there. And there's this wonderful scene where he just walks out, actually. And we see him driving home down the road and he throws his books out the window. He's going home and we're all happy for him, too. And I think that's a really interesting change as well. You know, we see how valid it is for him to want something like a working class job like that as a dream as opposed to college. But anyway, so what's happening in this clip is that Tim has come home and him and his brother have started this auto repair business. But something, a little something is going down on the side here. And, Tim isn't sure what's going on. And so he's confronting his brother
whose wife has a chronic medical condition.
Yeah, his wife has a chronic medical condition. And she's also pregnant. So he's got this new wife and she's pregnant. And
he has no insurance.
They have no insurance. And, you know, they're just trying to, you know, they're upstarts and getting this business going and just kind of trying to deal with the struggle of all this.
Nice listen.
Once or twice a week, they come by with a car, and I break it down to its component parts. They need it turned around in a quick time, and they pay really, really good for that.
That's stupidest.
Yeah, well, it's a plan, Tim. You got a better plan?
Yeah, Billy. We had a plan. I mean, we just had a party here and raised buckets of money.
Where's
all that money, then,
buckets,
Billy?
You want to know where that money is,
yeah,
Tim?
I do.
It went to two trips to the pharmacy, all right? And one meeting with a specialist. That money's gone. You got any other plans? Tell me about them.
Yeah, Billy. This.
Tim, it's a temporary thing.
Temporary thing.
It's temporary.
You have no idea what you're risking.
Look, nobody's getting hurt here, man.
You keep reminding me, like, every week that you have a family and this mechanic shop is some dream of yours.
The whole reason I'm doing this is for my family. This is going to prevent me from going bankrupt. It's going to make sure that Mindy's going to be okay and that my baby's going to be okay. All right? And once it's over with, everything will go back to normal.
Now I want to focus on that aspect of it because I think it's pretty clear there what the struggle was, what the choices were, but it's temporary. It's all going to go back to normal. Scott, I'm guessing that's something that you run into as well, trying to encourage people to say this. Yeah, once I get out of this mess, then I'm going to start putting some away.
Yeah, that's definitely a reaction. And you know what? It's understandable to a certain perspective. You know, the important thing for us on this issue is to just get people to stop and think and to really just try to put a plan together under any circumstance. And it's not easy. And I don't think anybody ever said that this is going to be easy. But our campaign and, you know, what we try to bring is just do what you can and own your piece of trying to solve the problem and think about the plan.
Michael Bowen, over the course of the history of the middle class, this has, I suppose, been one of the great promises. It's only temporary. Is there anything that's changed, you know, sort of over time in the general direction? Has it gotten harder and harder to get out of this? And is it now still possible? Is it really only temporary?
Well, I think that the economic conditions changed a great deal. Sort of the golden age of the middle class is regarded as this 1946 or so to 1973 or so period, where the economy was working, Keynesianism was working for the most part, and people really did gain some degree of upward mobility. A lot of it was through purchasing cheap housing with government loans, but there were steady jobs. We were the manufacturing kings of the world. And when the economy collapses in 73, and we see that Japan is our equal now, Germany is very close to us in economic productivity, the sort of idea that you could achieve something came into doubt. And it's something that we've never recovered from. And certainly people in the 40s and 50s wanted to work hard so that they could achieve this sort of success. The barriers weren't as obvious then because we were this country that was the world economic power. And when that is taken away and Keynesian economics no longer solves the problems, we've sort of been scrambling, and I think the middle class have been the victims of this, or have been scrambling to find a new ideology, a new economic idea that can put us back there. And so far, no one's given us anything that will work.
On the State of Things Today, our conversation will continue with my guest, Sarah Appel. She's a grad student at Duke. And on the phone is Michael Bowen, a visiting assistant professor of history at Westminster College in Wilmington, Pennsylvania. I want to thank Scott Spiegel, chief financial officer with the Durham-based America Institute of Certified Public Accountants, and Mikhail Grinston Weiss is director of the Assets Building Group and an associate professor at UNC School of Social Worker. Thank both of you for being on the program.
Thank you.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Our conversation will continue with your calls in a moment, 877-962-9862. On the State of Things, stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, talking about the middle class today. With me in the studio, Sarah Appel. She is a grad student in literature at Duke University and a blogger for the site Working Class Perspectives from the Center for Working Class Studies at SUNY Stony Brook. On the phone, Michael Bowen, visiting assistant professor of history at Westminster College in Wilmington, Pennsylvania. And joining us now from the cool climes of the Pacific Northwest is Will Wilkinson, co-author of the forthcoming book, Forgiving the Unforgivable, on the victims and perpetrators of the 2008 Mumbai terrorist attacks. You wrote an essay recently called The Invisible Growing Leaderless Revolution in America for the site commondreams.org. Will, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. I appreciate being on.
Good to have you, and we're taking phone calls at 877-962-9862. Our email address is sot@wnc.org. Will, tell us about the piece you wrote for Common Dreams. It proposes some real community-level responses to the economic crisis.
Yes, it was inspired by the abrupt closing of a local deli in a rather draconian way. And what we found in our little community is that there's a generosity inherent in neighbors towards each other. And when the federal level's failing us, when the broad spectrum of economic strategies aren't working, we kind of resort to local initiatives to help each other overcome what seem insurmountable problems unless we take action ourselves. So on the local level, we've been witnessing in our little town in Oregon a tremendous rise in generosity towards each other, sharing amongst community members. We have a time bank that's been there about a year now since we founded that, where we can offer services to each other without needing to exchange money. We just account for it online in our hours, and everyone's hour is worth what someone else's hour is. So that levels the playing field.
You got a great deal of response to your report and your article. What are you hearing from readers?
Well, the response was overwhelming. I mean, as a writer, I was thrilled to see this tide of appreciation for something that people could do. That was the predominant response I got. I was suggesting that if you had a few thousand bucks kicking around, rather than leaving it in a bank earning next to nothing, lend it to a neighbor to help increase value in your own local community. And people wrote saying, well, what a great idea. And then some had other ideas, and it seemed to spark this feeling that we could do something. I think that's the worst of this whole situation, the immobilization, the paralysis that we're at the whim of forces beyond our control and we can't do anything about it. So any little tidbit, any little possibility of taking personal initiative and making a positive difference, I think that's what my readers were really excited about.
Michael Bowen, has that changed over time in this idea of the middle class, your sense of control over the powers that be and your ownership of at least a part of the rock?
Well, you saw sort of a fundamental shift. And again, it's the 1970s, I think, are where all of the what we're harvesting was sown. The Keynesian idea didn't work. The communities, the unions, the federal government, the things that were supposed to solve the economic problems in a downturn no longer worked. And what you saw was a turn to individualism. Jefferson Cowie, who's a historian out of Cornell, has a great book on this very subject called Staying Alive, about labor movements in the 1970s. And you saw this sort of class consciousness go away, and you saw a rampant individualism come to the fore, the anti-government feelings in the wake of Watergate and Vietnam, and people sort of floated on their own for probably about the last 30 years, and what the other guest is speaking of really is sort of against that individualism, and it's very good to see if people are going in that direction to solve it themselves. That will be very much a shift if that took place on a national level.
Well, it's interesting because when you think about when you have this kind of a discussion and you talk about, you know, corporate control and the influence they have on our lives, the way the banks and financial institutions wreck the economy, and what do? Oh, don't regulate them. It seems that the alternative is always bigger government. So the alternative to that, to corporate control and hands off, is socialism or communism. But it strikes me that this third way that, Will, you're talking about has to do with a kind of communitarianism where we own our work, a co-op economy. The government doesn't own it. The corporation doesn't own it. The people who work there own it. How about that?
Exactly. And I'd like to raise a word I don't believe I've heard on the program yet, and that's the word scarcity. There's a tremendous scarcity consciousness. If you're poor, you want things you don't have. If you're rich, you want to protect the things you have. Both are really enslavement to the attitude of scarcity. What we're experiencing in our little town, and I'm encouraged that it's happening all across America, is the opposite of scarcity. It's the abundance that's there in friendships, in being a good neighbor, in looking at your resources, what you already have, and saying, I could share this riding lawnmower with my neighbor. He doesn't need to buy one. Why don't I let him use mine? In one way, it's a return to old values. And also something new today.
Yeah, well, the myth of insufficiency is fascinating given the argument for unfettered business activity. When you say hands-off business, you're promoting innovation, which is supposed to make our lives better. But in fact, we're working more. Americans work more than anybody in the world. So who's benefiting from all of the time-saving device? Not us,
exactly.
Right?
And something I like to mention, George Carlin famously said that to have the American dream, you need to be asleep.
Right.
And it's really time to wake up from the American dream. It's like the slingshot. I will go from being abjectly poor to absurdly rich by winning the lottery, being on American Idol, etc. Doesn't really happen. It's like being struck by lightning twice. So waking up from that dream, which really keeps us nose to the grindstone as slaves, we look around and say, hey, we're already wealthy. I've got all these friends. I've got all these resources. We can make something happen locally without waiting for the powers that be, banks, et cetera, to get their act together.
Let's go to the phones. Lisa is on the line. Hello, Lisa.
Hello. How are you today?
Good. How are you doing? You have a question for us?
Yes. How do you think, as a teacher, I've had adults say to me several times, we're creating such a sense of entitlement in our children. And I think my generation, I was a Generation Xer, I believe they called us, had a bit, a bit of the same thing going on. We were definitely parented, per se, much longer than previous generations had been. Our parents felt more responsible for us. Kids now expect to have a cell phone. They don't think that it's an optional thing that you get them. It's just everyone has one. We should have one, too. And it seems people say that young adults feel they should have a level of success as far as what they have at a very young age in comparison to older generations. Do you think that has attributed and will continue to attribute to some of the things going on as far as where we've gotten ourselves?
Well, expectations is a very good question, Lisa. And I know, Sarah, you don't want to, you know, you're worried about demonizing people for having what few possessions they have. On the other hand, expectation is what drives this consumerism and also what drives this kind of corporate growth that keeps us slaves, as Will says. How do you answer that question?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, to think about these, you know, entitlement, that's a word that we hear a lot, and, you know, expectation. But we also have to think about the, you know, I think we have this vision of necessity in our minds, you know, that we somehow know, you know, necessity is food, clothing, shelter. Again, it goes back to this austerity issue. But necessity is a lot, if you think about just the way that people actually live and interact. You know, having braces and straight teeth is a necessity to getting certain jobs. If you walk into a job interview with, you know, messed up crooked teeth because they were never fixed, you're probably not going to get it compared to the guy next to you. Having nice enough clothes, you know, that's also, you know, and these are social necessities. Having a cell phone to be able to communicate, you know, to be able to network, you know, even as a young person these days. I mean, these are I wouldn't call these things that, oh, you know, you should just live without these things if you're really, if you're really responsible and you're really, you know, participating in austerity. I think that these, you know, these have become necessities. And I think that we have to really examine that line between, you know, what is necessary and what is somehow excessive. And I guess my, you know, my thing is, if you've ever been poor, you just don't have the money to really buy, you know, in excess for the most part. Or, you know, yeah, there's a few people out there that maybe aren't making wise choices, but you don't have a lot of choices to begin with. And, you know, some people would rather, you know, have a, like, you know, if you need a cell phone to get a job, that might be more important than certain other things. So,
well, Will Wilkinson, I wonder to what extent these new communitarian values, should they take hold and scale up a bit, would actually change expectations of employers for straight. In other words, how dynamic a process is it once we realize we could make do with less and actually cooperate more?
Well, I think it has a tremendous effect to appreciate what you have. I mean, it's odd that we have such an urge to acquire all these things, and yet having them, we don't really appreciate them enough. They all take maintenance, and we're overwhelmed with that. So I think when we lower our expectations, I don't need the latest cell phone. I don't need everything that my neighbor has. I've got more time to focus with appreciation on what I already do have, and maybe discover that I can share it. You know, I don't need to just hoard it for myself. The other point I want to bring up here is that when we talk about kind of quality of life, it's really interesting. I think it's endemic to the dream state that 99% of the conversation relates to our exterior experience, stuff, our life out here in the world. But as we all know, what's also vitally important is our interior experience. How do we feel? And how we feel isn't just determined by the new cell phone we have or the car sitting in our driveway. There's a whole inner life, and you know, our experience in our little community is that as the focus goes off all the stuff and returns more to community values, sharing with each other, that we feel richer, not because we've got more stuff, and not even because we're sharing the stuff we have, but because we're bringing a little more balance back into our experience between the exterior and the interior, and having more of an interior life rather than just frantically pursuing the exterior.
And that can be a subjective experience that one can have if you are lucky enough to downsize a little bit. But Michael Bowen, I wonder historically about this crossover, because wasn't it once a value, a kind of middle class or standard American value, austerity, making do with less, not being ostentatious? Those things were once considered the values and virtues of American life. When did it cross over and become precisely the opposite?
It started crossing over, I think, about the 1950s and 1960s and accelerated. And if you look at our culture since the 80s, you know, the 80s was sort of the original era of excess, when Donald Trump and Lee Iacocca had best-selling novels and Dynasty and Dallas were taking the airwaves. Everything was about this ostentatious display of wealth, and that was part of the individualism aspect that was sort of dominant in that period. But it was also that the means to being fulfilled was through this material wealth. And it's going to be very hard to run sort of against the dominant culture trends. If you look at the sort of the riots we just had in London and other parts of the UK, I was following those fairly closely. because I've got some friends over there in the East End of London near where the riots were taking place. And the videos they put online and their cell phone photos that they took basically were people going into stores, and they weren't stealing necessities. They weren't stealing the clothes that they needed. They weren't stealing food. They were stealing Xboxes. They were stealing iPhone 4s, putting them up on Craigslist, trying to sell those things. And when you heard, you know, the BBC interviewed these people, they said they were giving it back to the rich. They were taking back what was theirs. And so there is this sense of entitlement that our culture, in many ways, not just popular culture through television, but also what we see in schools with the expectations parents have, helicopter parents, and what students expect. If anyone's ever given a student a C on an essay in higher education, they get the sense of entitlement back when the student doesn't understand why they got the A that they worked for. And we're really, there's a very deep cultural shift here that's going to have to take place before these communitarian ideas, which I think will be very good and very helpful, but before those become widespread, we're going to have to see a lot of dialing back of this in the culture.
And we've gone through the looking glass, really, when it comes to that, because now we're talking about the government being austere and cutting back on any of the asset-building possibilities, education, health, all of the mainstays of asset-building that really make us wealthy. There we should be austere, and yet we're still told from the highest levels of government, we're going to cut back on the things that you need, but you need to cut back on everything. You know, and but we want you to consume in order to keep our economy going. Will, that sounds like like we've actually gone through the looking glass.
Yeah, can I insert a comment here?
Sure.
This may sound a little trite, but when I got married 18 years ago, my wife and I made a deal that we would appreciate each other every day in a verbal sense. And what we've learned over the years is that because we've appreciated each other, our relationship has grown in value. And the meaning here relative to this conversation is we are very powerful in terms of our ability to increase the value of what we have and share in our life with others by the very act of appreciation. We all know the phenomena of a car depreciating. It decreases in value over time. Well, appreciation, I think, it's very misunderstood. It's actually the increase of value. So if I appreciate what I already have, friendships I have, things I own, rather than feeling entitled to more, then those things and those people, those relationships, actually go up in value. I mean, it's kind of like a secret for how you can increase your wealth without needing anything to really change externally.
So the key is gratitude.
Yeah, gratitude doesn't cost a thing, feels terrific both giving and receiving.
But as to Michael's, I think, implied question to you, Will, can you scale this up? Is it really possible, or does it only happen in places like Oregon where you happen to be in
Well,
spot
I
places?
Just finished this book, Forgiving the Unforgivable. I interviewed the 20-some folks who were in Mumbai. Two of their members were killed, four were shot. They found a way to appreciate their situation, forgive their attackers, and I mean, in a life and death situation, which is pretty extreme, very different from what I have in Oregon, they were able to do the very thing I'm talking about. So, yeah, I think it's possible.
Very briefly, Sarah.
No, I just wanted to sort of make a quick point about, I mean, I completely, agree with most of what Will is saying. But in order to appreciate what you have, you already have to, there's already an assumption, I think, of a baseline, a privilege and having there, you know, and I think that, one thing is that a lot of poor and, interdependence has been a part of the way that poor and working class communities interact with one another for, you know, for the last century, at least. I mean, this isn't a new thing, sharing, you know, I mean, because but that's been a response to economic conditions and not necessarily a choice.
Got to say goodbye. Thank you very much for being on the program. Will Wilkinson, author of the book Forgiving the Unforgivable, Michael Bowen, visiting assistant professor of history at Westminster College in Pennsylvania, Sarah Appel, graduate student at Duke. And thank you for listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.